avoid the entire subject of capitalism whenever something unfavorable might be said about it. Well, who did Mussolini and Hitler support once they seized state power? In both countries, a strikingly similar agenda was pursued. Labor unions and strikes were outlawed. Union property and publications were confiscated. Farm cooperatives were handed over to rich private owners. Big agribusiness farming was heavily subsidized. In Italy, child labor was reintroduced. In both Germany and Italy, the already modest wages of the workers were cut drastically. In Germany, from 25% to 40% cuts. In Italy, 50% wages cut. These were already rather modest wages as it was. In both countries, minimum wage laws, overtime pay, and factory safety regulations were abolished or turned into dead letters. Taxes were increased for the general populace, but lowered or eliminated for the rich and big business. Inheritance taxes for the wealthy were greatly reduced or abolished. Both Mussolini and Hitler showed their gratitude to their business patrons by handing over to them publicly owned and perfectly solvent steel mills, power plants, banks, steamship companies. Privatization, it's called. Privatization. Both regimes dipped heavily into the public treasury to refloat or subsidize heavy industry. Corporate welfareism, we would call it today. Both states guaranteed a return on the capital invested by giant corporations and assumed most of the risks and losses on investment. Sounds like savings and loan, if you ask me. As in all reactionary regimes, public capital was raided by private capital. The result of all of this? In Italy during the 1930s, the economy was gripped by recession, a staggering public debt, widespread corruption, but industrial profits rose. And the armaments factories busily rolled out the weapons. In Germany, unemployment was eased somewhat because there was a massive depression when they came in. And it was eased because of the massive arms program and the arms spending. But generally, poverty increased. I mean, if you cut wages 25% to 40%, poverty is increased no matter how many jobs you might create. But from 1935 to 1943, the net income of German corporate leaders rose 46%. In both countries, the conditions of labor deteriorated greatly. Speed-ups, dismissals, imprisonment for workers who complained about unsafe or inhumane work conditions, longer hours for less wages. You know, looking at this years ago, I used to say that fascism never really succeeded in solving the irrational contradictions of capitalism. Today, I believe it was never intended to solve the irrational contradictions of capitalism, at least not for the populace and for the people. Now I'm of the opinion that it actually, in a way, did succeed. It succeeded in solving the problems of capitalism, but only for the capitalists. Fascism offers a reactionary solution, not a social solution, to the contradictions of capitalism. It forces all the burdens and losses onto the working public. And in those days, by the way, there was any number of U.S. bankers and industrialists, including the likes of Henry Ford, who appreciated the way fascism was serving the moneyed class, and they were avid admirers. They gave political and even financial support to Mussolini and Hitler. The U.S. press was also filled with admiration. Fortune magazine, the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Chicago Tribune, you know, the free and independent press that speaks for all of us. They hailed Il Duce as the man who rescued Italy from radicalism and brought perfect harmony to the country. The image of an Italy in a state of perfect harmony is one that challenges the imagination in any case. In regard to Hitler, the U.S. press in the 1930s had a rather substantial contingent of give Adolf a chance group, you know. Let's give Adolf a chance. He means well. Oh, he may be a little rough here or there, but some of that sympathy was greased directly by Nazi money. You know, Hearst Hearst entered a deal where the Nazis, he had his wire service. The Nazis paid him something like 10 times the normal subscription, and in response, Hearst fired any reporters who filed negative stories and admonished the others to treat the Nazi Germany in a nice light. Gray Brechin told me that he found back issues of Hearst newspapers that contained guest columns by...
Email from school about the incident today.
Scary.
Tell me about it. Did you have any idea that was going on?
None. I mean, you saw Derek at the game last night, too. Did you have a clue?
No, but you know, teachers like me, parents, we don't always know as much as you guys do. Kids hear first about what's going on with other kids.
Half the time, it's rumors.
It can be hard to tell sometimes, but if you're ever concerned about a friend who's having trouble with alcohol, prescription drugs, bullying, violence, anything, you need to tell an adult. Mom or me, a teacher, coach, school counselor, someone you know and trust.
Dad, no kid is gonna tell an adult about that kind of stuff.
I get it, but if we don't know, we can't help. Speaking up about a problem, that's what helping a friend is all about.
For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
From KUT and KUTX Studios.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
Well, I had the opportunity while working with Charlotte Moore to, you know, do some work in coalition with the ACLU of Wisconsin, where I met some dynamic people who were just as committed to the work that I was doing. And they had a position open up for a statewide organizer. And I was encouraged to apply for the position. Initially, I didn't want to apply, but ultimately I went ahead, I applied for the position, and we launched a campaign called Smart Justice. It was a part of a national campaign to reduce the prison population by 50% and fight racism within the criminal legal system. And so they brought me on where I was able to continue to grow and evolve in my advocacy. We launched the campaign in Wisconsin around technical revocations, because in Wisconsin at the time, they were sending over 2,000 people back to prison each year.
Sean Wilson, organizing director of Dream.org Justice Team. As someone that lived experience with the criminal justice system in Wisconsin, Wilson feels that his path had ultimately placed him in a unique position to help others and make progress for real reform. Dream.org is a social justice movement committed to crossing divides, spurring innovation, enacting solutions, and inspiring the world, one that can fundamentally change how people come together to solve America's toughest problems and create a tipping point for systematic change where love and unity outpace hate and division. Formed in 2015, the nonprofit organization focuses on issues as mass incarceration, climate change, and poverty by advocating for new legislation, creating green jobs, and teaching low-income children about computer programming. I'm John L. Hansen, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Dream.org with Sean Wilson, In Black America.
As Glenn Martin said so long ago, that those who are closest to the problem are closest to the solution, but furthest from the power and the resources to change their condition. And so as an organization, we want to make sure that we're not only bringing system-impacted individuals proximate to power, we also want to give them the tools and the resources to move that power to bring about legislative change, to bring about systemic change and policy change all across the country. We're a country that has over 2.3 million people in prison on any given day.
As Senior Director of Organizing and Partnership at Dream.org, Sean Wilson is responsible for overseeing capacity building, leadership development, programs, and grassroots partnerships. Over the past 2.5 years, he has led the team in building one of the most transformational training programs in the nation. Born and raised in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Wilson has organized at the state and local level around policy change related to youth justice, voting rights, police reform, and criminal justice. Before joining the Dream.org Justice Team, Wilson was the ACLU of Wisconsin's Smart Justice Campaign Manager, where he managed the campaign to reform probation and parole. Wilson's mission includes mentoring youth and highlighting the changes that need to be made in our justice system to ensure children aren't raised behind bars. Recently in Black America spoke with Sean Wilson.
Well, life in Milwaukee has definitely changed since the time that I was growing up, but we still face, you know, the same or similar challenges. But growing up, you know, I was raised by my grandmother and my grandfather, who both worked for A. O. Smith and Eaton Corporation, which was a factory here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which provided a significant percentage of Milwaukee residents with employment. And so, you know, my grandmother raised me, kind of put a silver spoon in my mouth because she was aware of the things that were happening around us, and she wanted to deter me from going down that path. And so essentially any and everything that I wanted, she assured that I had it so that I wouldn't be tempted to go down that path. And so I grew up in a loving and a caring household. My mother was 17, 18 when she had me. And, you know, during that time, you know, grandmothers in the Black community and as well as grandfathers in the Black community had a tendency of coming in and raising their children's kids. And so I was one of those kids that was raised by my grandparents and was instilled a great deal of values and principles and morals. And I went to Franklin High School, Franklin Public School District. I was a Chapter 220 student, which was a program in Wisconsin where Black kids were shipped to suburban schools for elementary, middle school, and high school education. But growing up, you know, my life was pretty smooth. I had some challenges as a result of me being able to go spend summer months with my mother, who lived in the 53206 zip code, which is now known as the highest zip code, the highest incarcerated zip code for Black men in America. And so going every summer into this environment where I witnessed some things that I shouldn't have witnessed as a young Black boy. But this is the things that young Black boys witness frequently in these areas that is high crime, high violence. We witness these things, and there's one of two things that happens. You're going to steer clear from them, or you're going to become a part of them. And unfortunately, I began to emulate what I see. I became a part of the things that I saw as hard as my grandmother and grandfather attempted to steer me from those things. You know, when I went and spent summer months with my mother, the supervision was very lax. And so I was able to venture off into a variety of things that I didn't have any business venturing off into.
At 17, you slipped up. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, at 17, man, I slipped up, you know, poor decision-making, hanging out with, you know, the wrong crowd. And I'm sure that if they were asked this same question, I would also be considered that wrong crowd that they were hanging out with. But, yeah, we were, you know, doing a host of things, selling drugs, carrying guns, and just, you know, running rampant, you know, through our neighborhood, through our city, and causing all types of mayhem. And as a result of that, you know, we ended up ran too rampant and ended up getting charged and sentenced to a period of time in Wisconsin Department of Corrections. I was sentenced to a total of 50 years in Wisconsin Department of Corrections. I served a total of 17 years. And it was during that time of 17 years of my incarceration where I realized that this isn't life, man. You know, being dehumanized, having to shower with other men, having to, you know, come off of a visit and squat and turn around and lift my sack, and just dehumanizing treatment within the system of the Department of Corrections that most of society thinks is there to rehabilitate, reform. But that's not what the system is doing. The system is incapacitating individuals that come into its keep. And I was one of those individuals who realized immediately that this wasn't life. This wasn't the life that I wanted to live. but I understood that I had to be there for a period of time. And while I was there for that period of time, I decided to bury myself in books. I began to study. I began to come into understanding of myself. I began to come into understanding of the world. And I also began to come into understanding of my role within the world, my role within my community, and began to heal from that internal trauma. I began to evolve into the man that I am now as a result of those periods of solitude, those periods of soliloquy. I became the man that I am now, who's doing all types of advocacy work all across the country, supporting other brothers and sisters who are coming home from a period of incarceration, understanding their journey, understanding their trials and their tribulations through that process, as well as they re-enter society after that time away.
Once you did your time, what did you do once you got out?
You know, I often share this story. I like to say that I got out of prison before I got out of prison. And what I mean by that is that I made that transition mentally before I made it physically. And so upon my reentry, I hit the ground running, so to speak, meaning that I came home. I knew exactly what it is that I wanted to do. I had the family support that rallied around me, which enabled me to do a lot of the things that I wanted to do. I started sharing my story of how this system has impacted me. I began to talk about the importance of second chances. I began to talk about the need for systemic change within the criminal justice system. I understood that there were other young black boys who were just like me, who were coming up in similar environments, who were surrounded by all types of things that could potentially cause them to emulate what they saw. Emulate what they saw and ultimately become another statistic and find themselves on that lonely bus ride to one of Wisconsin's rural prisons. And so I wanted to use my story as a deterrent. I also wanted to use my story as a story of redemption, as a story that, yes, you made a mistake, you learned from your mistake, but now you have the opportunity to do something right. You have the opportunity to impart wisdom into the next generation. And so that's what I came home wanting to do and doing. I had the opportunity to meet this sister by the name of Charlene Moore, who ran the local nonprofit called Urban Underground, who was investing in young people. And, you know, she ended up overhearing my story on the kickball field. And, you know, I look at that experience. When I reflect on that experience, I always say that God always has those angels that are surrounding us. And Charlene was that angel that was eavesdropping on the conversation. And I'm grateful to God that she was eavesdropping on my conversation, where I was sharing with another gentleman that I just spent 17 years in prison and that I'm home now. I'm doing personal training. I'm doing mentorship. And she overheard that and walked up to me and said, "Hey, did you just say that you spent 17 years in prison?" I affirmed that, and she said, "I need you," and then walked away. I didn't know what that meant, what it entailed, but 6 months later, I was being flown to Boston, Massachusetts to participate in the conference around juvenile justice and the need for systemic change within that system. And as someone who went to prison at the age of 17, as someone who lived 24/7, 365 within this system, who better to talk about what viable solutions exist to begin to transform this system, to begin to restore and repair the harm that this system has done, than someone who has been harmed by the very system? And so from that point forward, I've been doing advocacy work at the local and national level as a result of that introduction with Charlene Moore about 7 or 8 years ago.
This is In Black America. We'll be back with more of our conversation in a moment. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're speaking with Sean Wilson, Organizing Director of DREAM.org, Justice Team. Mr. Wilson, before you joined the Justice Team, you were a member of the ACLU of Wisconsin Smart Justice Campaign Manager?
Yes.
Talk to us about that.
So I had the opportunity while working with Charlene Moore to, you know, do some work in coalition with the ACLU of Wisconsin, where I met some dynamic people who were just as committed to the work that I was doing. And they had a position opened up for a statewide organizer and I was encouraged to apply for the position. Initially, I didn't want to apply, but ultimately, I went ahead. I applied for the position, and we launched a campaign called Smart Justice. It was a part of a national campaign to reduce the prison population by 50% and fight racism within the criminal legal system. And so they brought me on where I was able to continue to grow and evolve in my advocacy. We launched the campaign in Wisconsin around technical revocations, because in Wisconsin at the time, they were sending over 2,000 people back to prison each year for technical violations, something as small as moving from apartment A to apartment B without notifying their probation agent, and that can send someone back to prison, or having contact with individuals who were felons, that could send someone back to prison. So it was these arbitrary rule violations that were sending so many people back to prison, increasing our prison population at a cost to taxpayers of over $200 million. And we didn't think that that was right. And so we launched a campaign called End Crimeless Revocation, where we did statewide tours educating people on what a technical revocation is or crimeless revocation is, why people should be concerned, what can they do to begin to change these things. And we were able to turn people out for lobby days where they had conversations with their elected officials and encouraging them to not only stop this practice, but pass legislation to end this practice. And so we were able to successfully run a campaign that built capacity, but we weren't successful in getting legislation passed because in Wisconsin, as you know, or as you may have heard, it's a gridlock. You know, you have a Republican-controlled legislature, and there's a lot of unwillingness to pass bipartisan legislation that's going to move us forward as a state. And so we had a few champions on the other side of the aisle who agreed that this was a system that we needed to begin to address. We got to the 11th hour where we were going to introduce some legislation, and it was halted. And so we weren't able to move that legislation over the finish line, but we're still, you know, putting our feet to the pavement. We're still having conversations. We're still building relationships with elected officials and getting them proximate to individuals who are impacted by this, and hoping that we can eventually get some legislation passed that will stop this practice indefinitely.
How did you become the organizing director of DREAM.org?
Well, I always go back to relationship building. I'm a big believer in the power of relationships. And so while I was working at the ACLU, I had an opportunity to work with this guy named Janos Martin, who had done a significant amount of advocacy work in the national space of criminal justice reform. He, at the time, worked for the ACLU as the campaign strategist, and he and I frequently met and discussed strategy. He came in and also discussed strategy as well. He eventually left the ACLU to run for Manhattan DA. He was unsuccessful in that bid, but he ended up coming back into the advocacy space at DREAM.org. And, you know, knowing my work, knowing my commitment and my passion for this work, a position came open. He saw that I was, you know, the perfect individual for this role, told me about it. I applied, went through the interview process, and I'm grateful that the organization saw that I will be a value add to the work that they are doing. The mission of DREAM.org is closing prison doors and opening doors of opportunity. That mission aligns with who I am as an individual. It aligns with my values, my purpose. And so I was excited to join a team that we have now grown to about 15 system-impacted individuals who are doing some amazing work all across the country, transforming lives, changing systems, and also providing system-impacted individuals with the tools and the resources that they need to be successful. As Glenn Martin said so long ago, that those who are closest to the problem are closest to the solution, but furthest from the power and the resources to change their condition. And so as an organization, we want to make sure that we're not only bringing system-impacted individuals proximate to power, we also want to give them the tools and the resources to move that power to bring about legislative change, to bring about systemic change and policy change all across the country. We're a country that has over 2.3 million people in prison on any given day. We have 600,000 people who are returning home from prison each year. And so we have to be mindful that that 600,000 who's returning home to our communities each year, we have to be mindful that they are in need of our support. They are in need of our empathy. And many of them, unfortunately, are Black and brown people. And so how can we show up for them so that they can show up for their families and their communities? And I believe that that is the work that we're doing here at Dream.org with our Empathy Network, a network of over 4,000 advocates, allies, family members, crime survivors. We're providing them with the tools and the resources that they need to organize their communities, to educate their communities, to turn people out and move the legislature to pass legislation that's going to move their states and ultimately the country forward.
So Dream.org is a national entity?
Yep, we're a national nonprofit. We're all over the country. Our headquarters is in Oakland, California. We're a national organization that is led by our great CEO, Nisha Anand, who herself experienced incarceration in Burma when she was over there passing out pamphlets. She unfortunately was incarcerated for a period of time, and that is what drives her, that experience amongst other things. But we're an organization that believes in common ground. We don't believe that one party can do this. We believe that both parties must do this. We believe that everyone has a seat in a role in moving us forward as a country around all of the issues that impacts us as Americans. And the only way that we can do that is by coming to the table around common ground, coming to the table around the things that we agree on. When we come to the table with our disagreements, we're not going to get anywhere. But if we come to the table with our agreements, we're going to move the needle forward. And that's what we were able to do a few years ago, predating my arrival here. But I was at the ACLU, and the ACLU was supporting the First Step Act, which to date has freed over 30,000 individuals from federal prison. Dream.org was the leading organization to get this over the finish line. And Dream.org had conversations with Republicans and Democrats alike, stressing the importance of this legislation, which ultimately passed and was signed by the president. And we have now, 5-6 years after the passage of this legislation, freed 30,000+ individuals who have returned home to their families and in their communities. And the recidivism rate of those 30,000 that have come home under the First Step Act is lower than the national recidivism rate. And so that is an example of the impact of transformational legislation that is passed when both sides come to the table agreeing that we need to work together to move this country forward.
Why is it important for a mentorship program for young African-American boys?
I think it's important that we're imparting to the next generation the successes that we have had and also deterring them from the challenges that they may potentially encounter. Not only deter them from those challenges, but give them the tools that they need to navigate those challenges when they come upon them. I think mentorship, which has played a significant impact on my life while I was incarcerated, I had the opportunity to be mentored by so many men who had life sentences, who would never see the light of day. I remember a conversation I had with a lifer where I asked him, you know, how does he navigate daily life knowing that he would never walk upon the earth as a free man? And he said he gives life. And when I asked him to unpack that, he said, individuals such as yourself and others who are coming into this prison that has a release date, I have a responsibility to give you all life. And the way I give you all life is by conveying to you the wisdom that I've acquired over the years, also outline paths of success that you yourself can go down. And so I believe that mentorship coming from that lens is of utmost importance for young Black and brown boys here in America who are faced with so many challenges, who are pressured by social media, by all of the media outlets. We're painted in such a threatening image. We have so much weight on our shoulder. Those of us who have navigated these challenges and overcame these challenges, we have a responsibility to ensure that we're showing up for our young brothers and our sisters and letting them know that the image that is being painted of them in the media, on social media, through music, is not them. We have to communicate to them their greatness. We have to not only communicate it to them, but we have to also exemplify it. And I'm very grateful that I have the opportunity to do just that. When I was doing state work here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, I had the opportunity to participate in a documentary called Growing Up Milwaukee, where I mentored a young man who the judge said to him, hey, if you come back in front of me, your life is over with. And so that probably was around a year or so after I came home from prison. The director of the documentary ended up seeing or reading my story in the newspaper and reached out and said, hey, I have this young man. I'm filming this documentary. I'm growing up Milwaukee. Behind every statistic, there's a story. Would you mind mentoring this young man? And I met this young man, and he had so much life. He had so much life, so much potential. And I just wanted to hear, you know, what was causing him to go down the path that he was going down that led to his incarceration and could have potentially led to an indefinite period of incarceration for him. I wanted to understand what was happening that brought about that. And when I came into his house and recognized what was happening on the home front, I realized that I had to impart to him the importance of not allowing the things around him drive him down the path of no return. And so from that experience, I have been able to continue to mentor other Black boys. And this young man that I had the opportunity to mentor in this film has gone on to graduate from high school. He's working. He has his own home. And I believe he's expecting a child soon. But I reflect back on that moment and when my first meeting with him. And all young Black boys need is someone that is going to sit down and listen to their challenges, listen to their hopes and their dreams, and let them know, reaffirm for them that everything that they want to do, they can do. And not only listen to them and remind them that they're able to do these things, but also figure out what pathways exist that we can introduce them to so that they can pursue the hopes and dreams that they have.
Couple of more questions, Mr. Wilson. In your opinion, why is the prison system not living up to its mission statement?
That's a huge question, John. And I would say that the current prison system is a continuum of slavery. The Constitution says that involuntary servitude shall not exist except as a punishment. And so with that being the foundation of this current prison system, you have a majority of people who are Black and brown who are being, in my opinion, railroaded to a certain extent into this system in such a way that we have a ballooning, overcrowded prison system where we represent 5% of the world's population, but we represent an even greater, higher percentage of the world population when it comes to incarceration. And so I think it's not working because when individuals go to prison, they're not being rehabilitated upon entry. The prison system, the way that it is structured for incapacitation. The environment in and of itself is very, it lacks stimulation. It's very stimulant depriving. If you walk through a prison, just the paint on the walls deprives you of your senses. There's a lack of green space. There's a lack of information that individuals have access to that allows them to begin to rehabilitate themselves, that allows them to heal. The prisons, in my opinion, is a microcosm of the world. And you have administrators who don't have any intent on transforming the lives of the individuals who are coming into the prison.
Sean Wilson, Organizing Director of Dream.org Justice Team. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to your future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
This is Ebony Spectrum on WRCT Pittsburgh.
On September 23rd, 1957, the Little Rock Nine desegregated Central High School. Now, 67 years later, Empowerment Temple AME Church honors that legacy. Join us for a powerful walk in support of reparations on September 23rd, 2024. Led by Reverend Dr. Robert Richard Allen Turner, we'll walk 40 miles from Carroll Park in Baltimore to the White House in Washington, D.C. Stand with us as we make history again. For info, call 410-801-8888.
This is the Black World Media Network, putting the global diaspora issues up front. Professor Ron Daniels is the president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century. And this is From the Desk of the Professor.
Message to the Orange Man. stop insulting, assaulting, and hating on Haitians. This repugnant excuse for a human being, the Orange Man, aka Agent Orange, seems to have it in for Haiti and Haitians. Lest we forget, he began his MAGA mad denigration of black nations when he was a fake president by calling Haiti a shithole country. Now this monster of a moral midget is at it again, this time verbally insulting, assaulting, and hating on Haitian immigrants in Springfield, Ohio, by spewing inflammatory lies claiming that Haitian immigrants are capturing and eating the pets of other residents of Springfield. Despite emphatic denials of this bald-faced lie by the city manager of Springfield and the governor of Ohio, Agent Orange and his demented vice presidential running mate continue to double down on the insults, assaults, and hate for Haiti immigrants, the vast majority of whom are in this country legally. In fact, their energy and ingenuity have revitalized what was a decaying, dying city. These verbal insults, assaults, hate, and lies are dangerous because they are fueling death threats and bombings targeting Haitians in Springfield and across the country. The insults, assaults, and hate by Agent Orange tap into the ugly xenophobic white nationalism, which is a pillar of the Orange Man's MAGAism. The insults, assaults, and hate must be condemned and stopped. They constitute yet another moral and political reason for the rainbow forces of conscience and goodwill to mobilize and organize, to march on ballot boxes in record numbers, to crush the Orange Man and flush the poison of MAGAism out of the systems of society in the USA. Hashtag, stop hating Haitians.
That viewpoint was ripped from the desk of the professor, Ron Daniels. Listen daily for a view on a myriad of issues from the desk of the professor. This is the Black World Media Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, my fellow Americans, the 46th president of these United States, Joseph R. Biden.
Thank you. Now look, I love Kamala. Thank you all. As the saying goes, you all brung me to the dance. Folks, I want to get something straight at the outset. I love Kamala. But Delaware State's the best HBCU in America. They're the ones, you think I'm kidding. I was a 29-year-old kid, and they embraced me. They embraced me like you can't imagine. And we won the second youngest person in American history because of HBCU called Delaware State. And by the way, I hired a young man from Delaware State named Tony Allen. Came to work for me. While there, I encouraged him to continue to get his extend his degree. He got his doctorate and left. He became president himself. I don't know how the hell that happened so quick. But Tony, thank you, man. I've been introduced countless times, but never quite like that. And I mean it, Tony, from the bottom of my heart, I'm deeply moved. By God's grace, we're true friends, and Delaware State will always have a special place in my heart, for real. And to the presidents and administrators of our 101 historic black colleges and universities, it's an honor to celebrate, and I mean celebrate, HBCU Week with you. Before I begin, I want to make a quick reference to the attempted assassination against our former president in Florida yesterday. I commend the Secret Service for the expert handling of the situation, and the former president is protected from harm and the subject is in custody. An acting head of the Secret Service is in Florida today assessing what happened and determining whether any further adjustments need to be made to ensure the safety of our former president. Let me just say, there is no, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart, those of you who know me, many of you do, no place in political violence for political violence in America. None. Zero. Never. I've always condemned political violence. I always will in America. In America, we resolve our differences peacefully, the ballot box, not at the end of a gun. America suffered too many times the tragedy of an assassin's bullet. It solves nothing and just tears the country apart. We must do everything we can to prevent it and never give it any oxygen. Folks, now to today's event. It's an honor to recognize HBCU excellence in our nation. I see excellence in it every single day. I see this weekend the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation. I tell you what, the foundation gala, only about 3,500 people there. And I was happy, and I've been wanting to do this to celebrate the first ever White House brunch to celebrate Black excellence. Black excellence. Which many of you and your alumni attended. It's about time to point out what's already been done. I'm proud to have the most diverse administration in history. It taps into the full, I mean it. I made a commitment, my administration is going to look like America. It taps into the full talents of our nation, including graduates of HBCUs like our amazing vice president is. Folks, together Kamala and I know that an education makes a person free. HBCU's education makes you fearless as well. It matters. I mean it. More than 180 years, born under the shadow of slavery and Jim Crow, HBCUs have instilled a sense of purpose and freedom, a commitment to make a difference for all their students, to lift up not just yourselves, but others along the way. Institution grounded in the belief that every American of every race and every background, every zip code, and you know me, I mean this, should have a fair and equal chance to go as far as their God-given talents can take them. That's who we are. That's what we stand for. But as I've said before, we face an inflection point in history. It comes along every six or seven generations. One of those rare moments in our history when the decisions we make now, right now, are going to determine the fate of our nation and the world for the next decades, for six, seven decades to come, and I mean it. When I wasn't going to run for president again after my son died coming back from Iraq, I decided that I was going to write another book. I was going to write a book about the inflection points in world history, how it changed history, going all the way back to dealing with the printing press and how it's changed everything. But look, we're still in the battle. We're still in the battle for the very soul of America. In 2020, I ran, and I give you my word, this was the reason. I ran to redeem the soul of America, to restore decency and dignity to the office of the presidency. I ran to rebuild and expand the backbone of America, the middle class. And I ran to unite the country, remind ourselves that we can do anything we want to do when we do it together. Yes. 4 years later, we made incredible progress because Kamala and I kept our commitment to you to ensure that all our students and all of our colleges and universities should be able to succeed. That's why I signed an executive order reestablishing the White House initiative in HBCUs after my predecessor allowed it to lapse. Thank you, Dr. Trent, for leading it. I can't see you out there, but I'm sure you're there. Thank you, Tony and Dr. Glover, for leading my presidential board on HBCUs. I'm also proud to lead the first administration in history to have a working group from the Divine Nine in the White House. I got it, man. I mean, maybe a white boy, but I ain't stupid. I figured out real quick. And by the way, it's an official group in the White House. Together, we got to work right away with our signature investment in addressing one of the most pressing issues for HBCUs. We all know, and I mean this sincerely, that HBCU students are just as capable as any other students. No, but But HBCUs don't have the endowments, like many other colleges and universities, that are able to fund research labs, improve campus infrastructure, and so much more. That's why I'm proud to be delivering on a record $17 billion. $17 billion for HBCUs. The most ever any administration has ever committed. Stay where you were. We've already distributed well over $1 billion. Folks, look, I want to make something clear at the outset. If you notice, the spending we've done, I have to hold back there, the spending we've done has not fundamentally increased the deficit like the other guy did. No, seriously. It grows the economy. The more educated, how can we lead the world without being the most educated nation in the world? How can we lead the world without reaching out to the young people of this country to improve their capacity? You know, it's helped everything from HBCUs to do everything from providing financial aid via Pell Grants to building new housing and research labs, to prepare black students for jobs and industries of the future in high demand, fields like cybersecurity, engineering, biochemistry, healthcare, and so much more. But that's not all. Together, we spearheaded one of the most equitable economic recoveries in history. How can we be the strongest economy in the world and lead the world without the best education system, without taps into the talents of every student? Every student. In fact, my Council on Economic Advisors issued a report this spring on the economic power of HBCUs. Here's what they found. They found HBCUs are engines of economic mobility in our country, raising the standard of living for everybody, for real. Despite representing only 3% of the colleges and universities in America, HBCUs are responsible for 40% of all black engineers, 50% of all black teachers, 70% of all doctors and dentists, and 80% of all black judges, and I'm increasing that number, too. But that's not all. My CHIPS and Science Act, which I was committed to, finally got it done. We ensure we create more hubs of innovation at HBCUs, create pathways to develop more researchers, and grow a diverse semiconductor workforce here at home. For example, I was in New York where I announced a significant CHIPS investment with Micron, a leading semiconductor company that parented and partnered with Norfolk State University to build a 6,000-square-foot high-tech facility for students and other researchers. My National Science Foundation just awarded $2 million to Clark Atlanta University to support their work in the HBCU CHIPS network, fueling semiconductor research and development, and a workforce capacity at HBCUs. This is in addition to last week's announcement of $10.5 million for National Science Foundation grants to facilitate STEM research at more than a dozen HBCUs, including Central State University, a project to build a semiconductor R&D capacity. I'm also excited to announce that four HBCUs, Fort Valley State University, Rust College, Savannah State University, and Shaw University, are receiving additional critical funding to boost their STEM programs, prepare their students for these incredible opportunities. And moving forward, I've encouraged semiconductor companies to continue to create and expand partnerships with HBCUs as they invest in American manufacturing. And Vice President Harris and the National Space Council she leads are ensuring the federal government, industry partner, and HBCUs collaborate in opportunities for space-related technology and innovation, the future. And folks, my Office of Science and Technology Policy is developing and sharing the best approaches across the entire government how to expand STEM research and investments in HBCUs. In addition, my administration continues to diversify the federal workforce, starting by opening doors of opportunity like the HBCU Scholar Program that celebrates its 10th anniversary. I want to congratulate the 2024 cohorts of scholars, the largest cohort, all of whom are with us. Stand up if you're here. If I'm still around, one of you are president, make sure you don't say who Joe who, okay? We also know that black studies show black students who have black teachers are significantly more likely to graduate from high school. And we've known this for a long time, enroll in college. That's why my Department of Education has provided $450 million to ensure the teachers in our schools reflect diversity in our country. These small things matter a lot. For example, this funding has gone toward the Augustus F. Hawkins program, which is preparing the next generation of teachers at HBCUs. We're the first administration to secure funding for this program, providing almost $40 million to date. And today, I'm proud to announce four more HBCUs: Grambling State University, Morehouse College. Oh, I'm so tired of hearing about Morehouse, man. I did the commencement at Morehouse. One graduate said, came up to me, "Mr. President, you're not a Morehouse man." Of course, I get was doing the commencement. North Carolina Central University and Prairie View A&M University. They're being awarded new grants to increase teacher diversity. We know that while a college degree is still a ticket to the middle class, that ticket is becoming too expensive. That's why we increased the maximum Pell Grant by $900 a year, the largest increase in a decade. It matters because HBCUs have twice the percentage of Pell Grant students as non-HBCUs. And my administration also relieved the debt of 5 million Americans, including a significant number of black borrowers. That means you can now start a business. You can buy a home, save for your children's school, give back to your community. And it grows the economy for everybody. It's not the cost, it grows the economy. There's so much more we're doing to help more HBCU students walk into a life of generational wealth and to be providers for their families, leaders of the communities, dreamers and doers of the nation and history. We gather together in a year, University of Brown versus the Board of Education, discrimination in employment and public place, in which we've just observed its 60th anniversary, an alum of Lincoln University and Howard Law School. By the way, Lincoln's closer to Wilmington than it is to Philly. I've been there many times. And generations of HBU educators and students come who came before. It opens the doors of hope and opportunity for a generation of black Americans and for the entire United States of America. It really does. But today, affirmative action and the values of diversity, equity, and inclusion are under attack like not long since I started as a young civil rights guy. Books are being banned. History is being erased. HBCUs have received bomb threats. And right now, lies and hate are being spread about Haitian Americans in Ohio. It's wrong. It's simply wrong. And it must stop. There are those who want a country for some of us, but not for all of us. But I've always believed that the promise of America, and I mean it sincerely, is big enough for everyone to succeed. No, I really mean it, everyone. And there's been no more important voice for that truth in the black community and our HBCUs. That's what I see in your students, future doctors and researchers, curing cancer, artists shaping our culture, fearless journalists and intellectuals challenging convention, preachers and advocates inspiring us all. You prove that black history is American history. It is American history. And black excellence is American excellence. Let me tell you something. If I show up on your campus, you better be nice to me. Look, let me close with this. Mary McLeod Bethune was the highest ranking black woman of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's administration. A pioneering educator, activist, she founded the proud HBCU Bethune-Cookman University. Here's what she said. She said, the freedom gates are half ajar. We must pry them fully open. That's what I'm trying to do. Pry them fully open. For over 180 years, HBCUs have been prying open freedom's gates. For the past 4 years, Kamala and I, with the help of all you and great leaders out there in the city that I serve with in the Congress and the Senate, are pushing right alongside them. And God willing, as HBCU graduate, the future president of the United States is going to soon be sitting behind the Resolute desk, pushing the gates of freedom open once and for all. Folks, you've probably heard me say this before. We just have to remember who the hell we are. No, I mean it. We're the United States of America. There is nothing beyond our capacity when we act together. Nothing, nothing, nothing. We're the only nation in history that's come out of every crisis stronger than we went in. That's because of you, because of all of us. We're a diverse nation. Therein lies our strength when we unite. So God bless you all, and may God protect our troops. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Typical arrogant American, no prescribed medicine, I'm sick as I ever been. Rolling out of the dealership in the McLaren. These rappers is Peter Pan, I'm Pan-African. Space Invader blacking them, mixing Alexander McQueen with Hayter Ackerman. Real rapture in the form of a living man. I don't give a damn, not a mortal can test me. See, I don't get exam, I'm a high priest and a wild beast. Once warrior, now chief, the mouthpiece of the foul east. And I'm a rock'em sock'em robot hop. I drop bombs, any flow I got. Come at you like .com. She said, no, I'm not. For the run of the mill drill, I'm still trail. The flame through with a real deal. I don't go aside with the oddness, your highness. It's with a pantheon of the gods, as I promise. I know for being brutally honest. The lyricism is mirror true to you to rewindness. I'm a killer, but it ain't about to be with kindness. I believe the industry about to see a conquest. Changing of the mindset. Money just a concept. Never been an object. Even when my mother was living up in the project. Now my rating is high than young Richard Bryant. Still speak on my mind, just in a different dialect.
It takes two to make anthropology. The student and the studied. That being the case, it is time for the study to examine the student and to evaluate its own.
I said, I seen it all, I had it all, and I ain't mad at all. This rabbit sauce gravitates like a cannonball. Staying up all night, throwing my sleep pattern off. I need a doctor on call to keep Adderall. Position of my commission is trilateral. You fucking with me, you tripping for trying that at all. I mess around, make a call, get the Gatton ball. I know people, it's a small world after all. My credit card say it's all world at the mall. My broad looking like she's Cinderella at the ball. Reborn every January like a Capricorn. From downtown, no Ryan Lewis and Macklemore. It's yours truly, I'm Paul Mooney, I'm George Clooney. I'm fully immersed in the craft, bringing awards to me. The bass player said he gon' sue me. I gave the finger to him, the Lord gave a round of applause to me. My soul winning, I've been gold tinted. Cold sentence, throw a pen, a nigga gone till it's no limit. The vision came to me so vivid. My observation wasn't money for the taking, I'ma go and get it. Y'all know my everyday lay no costume. I murk rappers and they can't play no possum. Another studio, but it's the same old outcome. I told my nigga small visions, baby, we got one. This
accurate scholarship and free dedicated artists will reveal a singularly important thing. Racism was and is not only a mark of ignorance, yeah. It was and is a monumental fraud.
Overhaul, 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 overhaul.
Thank you for listening. WRCT Pittsburgh.
Listening to Chop Chop on WRCT.